of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail, and there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The truth is out there.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subject.
Okay, you just blew my mind.
And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hello there, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness. How are you?
I love already this week's show, and we haven't even recorded it yet. But because we've done so many kind of theme shows, and because we've been, just so much looking back at the best and the worst of the previous year, and then our resolution shows and guests and all that stuff, I'm just excited about a good old-fashioned Donnybrook where we just have dozens of different topics piled up to get
fantastic.
To.
Fantastic. Just a potpourri, a knockabout, a right chin wag.
Wow. As opposed, what I hate are the incorrect chin wags.
Well, don't kid yourself. Those exist.
Right. Yeah. That's isn't that an indigenous tribe in very northern Canada? The incorrect Chinawags. Okay, so the thing that I was most looking forward to is I thought after all these weeks, we must have some listener emails to start the show with. That's what I was so excited about that. And so I went through all the emails. Really, nothing. I mean, there is one I'm going to mention from our good friend Barry Murphy, but it was more or less just calling our attention to something. So we'll talk about that in a minute, but finally, I saw one from a woman named Michelle Montgomery, and I thought, okay, this is going to be interesting. It may not be show-specific, because we use that chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com email address not only for our loyal listeners to write to us about what they want us to discuss on the show, one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Correct.
But we also use it for press inquiries for people who might want to interview one or the other of us about our various show business activities, our creative endeavors. It's also an email that people can reach out to us, let's not lie, with lucrative employment opportunities.
That's true. Please keep them coming.
And sure enough, I got quite excited because this email from Michelle Montgomery seemed to fall firmly into that category.
Wow. Don't tell me the subject heading is lucrative employment opportunities.
No, it's more specific than that. And as you know, I've spent a great deal of time working as a cinematographer over these last half dozen years or so. And so sure enough, the subject heading is Need a Good DP.
Wow, that's you.
Exactly. Who would not want to hire me as a cinematographer? And the answer to that question is apparently Michelle Montgomery, because the DP in the subject heading didn't mean what I thought it meant.
Okay. Let me go.
No,
DP.
I don't think, given the fact that apparently we have some young people who listen to the show, I don't think I should explain what DP stood for. NSFW. So,
wow, really?
Anyway, but thank you, Michelle Montgomery, for the kind offer, but Dean and I are unavailable. Hey, I'm going to predict the future.
Am I naive? I can't think of what the hell you're talking
God
about.
God bless you for not knowing.
It'll take me a while.
Yeah. So, well, let me just say that, you know, baseball, spring training has begun because, of course, it's the middle of winter. And in baseball parlance, a DP is a double play.
Oh, fantastic.
And that leads you on the way towards what DP in this iteration might mean. Okay, so moving along, I'm going to predict the future. And the future is that we'll soon be bringing back the live event of the week and focusing on a certain Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Will we not?
Oh, we will, because I'll be there at that very festival.
I know. I'm hoping that you'll promote a little bit right now.
Oh, I get it. That thing that I never do. Promote all my things that I do. That I just expect people to show up, and they don't.
Hey, you do have a new Facebook page, Dean Haglund page. It's all things Dean Haglund, because Facebook limits you on the amount of friends that you have, and you've had so many additional friend requests and people who send emails that get filtered because they're not your friends. And so you've created a new Dean Haglund page that allows people to contact you directly, message you, gets to see all the same posts. You're not going to, you're certainly,
sneak one through.
Yeah, you're going to absolutely make sure that they know everything that's going on. And so we encourage people not only to like that page, but to make sure that they get all notifications from that page so that they can keep up to date with you.
Yeah, wouldn't that be good?
You're not going to do any heavy lifting on this show at all, are you?
Well, okay, what shall I say? Holy smokes, I got a ton of shows coming up.
I want to hear about the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Okay, is this seems a bit kind of like a fringe festival kind of thing from when I was looking at the website and the different people who come. Is it all, are there plays? Are there?
No, it's all comedy. Okay. So it's a sketch comedy, improv comedians from around the world. Rich Hall is going to be there, some other big names. It's actually kind of a big to-do. It's a second only to Montreal Just for Laughs, believe it or not.
And do they show films? Because if so, why didn't we think of this?
Well, you I think you sent me a link.
No, somebody to the Melbourne International Film Festival. That's I'm trying to get Lady Killers into the Melbourne International Film Festival. Film Festival,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Not the comedy festival. Does the comedy festival show films? That's the question on the table I ask you, sir.
Right.
And remember, you are under oath.
Damn it. To the best of my knowledge, I don't believe they do, actually. Sadly, I think it's all live. Sadly, happily, it's all live comedy at 200 venues. No, maybe 50 venues all through Melbourne.
So you're going to be bringing your improv X-Files show?
Yes. That's rarely been seen down there, I'll tell you what.
And will it work? Now, you've been doing the show, right? This is the show you've been doing in Newton, right?
Yeah, Newtown, South Sydney, the neighborhood in Sydney that I live in. I've been doing that show, but I've been tweaking it. And also because of the paper laughs, the pressure is really off. So I've been experimenting a lot with the form and developed a couple new things that I'll be laying out in Melbourne.
Very exciting. Now, are you still doing the Sydney show?
I am. It's going to be one tonight. Now, the problem is the 505 Theater lacks air conditioning. So when it's at 35 degrees Celsius and 80% humidity, it makes for, not just everybody wilted, but, there was a reason David Letterman kept his theater really cold, because that made you laugh more. And when it's really hot, there actually is a noticeable lack of enthusiasm for improv, sad to say.
Will this be going on in Sydney every week, or is this the last week for a while?
No, I'm doing every week for at least till March 21st when I head down to Melbourne. And then
How many shows in Melbourne?
I'm doing only 10. Can you believe it? 10 shows in the first part of the festival, which is where you want to be. And the magic number, 10, at a 130-seat theater at Trade Hall in the old council chambers.
And of course,
every night at 9:30, of course.
Every night at 9:30 in the same venue?
Yeah, same venue. And then Sunday I have an 8:30 show. And then Monday night is my only night off. So it'll be a solid week and a half of shows every night.
And of course there's 10, Roman numeral for 10, X, and it is the X-Files Improv Show.
Oh my God, why didn't I see that? Holy shit.
You know, I played at the opening of the show, the after whatever commercial of the week Blog Talk Radio has seen fit to put before our show. There is a 60-second spot for a documentary we made called The Truth Is Out There. And I must say that in recent weeks, there's been a kind of a resurgence of interest in the film. And some might say, of course, because with the X-Files revival and the linkage between you and some of the similar themes, and I'm sure that's part of it. But it is interesting how people have been getting in touch with me and getting in touch with us about the film and ordering the film. And it's available in so many fantastic, fantastic forms, my favorite being the Blu-ray. But people getting in touch on a variety of different topics. And that's the thing about the movie that continues to be so much fun for me, is that we met people from such a widely different set of backgrounds in terms of their interests and their research and their expertise. And so the appetite and the interest in this film, again, is it's so unique for each person who comes to the movie. And then hopefully they get opened up to a series of really brilliant and interesting people that they hadn't known just through their own particular expertise.
Fantastic. I love that. And what a great time for that to be happening when so much diversity is going on, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is, like we say, it's like connecting different synapses in the brain. When you realize that wisdom in one field or endeavor might just have applications in, dare I say, all fields of endeavor? I mean, I as above, so below, as within, so without. I think, as I say in my acting class each week, I if they ever catch me in my acting class teaching anything that doesn't have quote-unquote real-world applications, if I'm only teaching things that will help you succeed as an actor and does not help you succeed at life, then call me on it. Of course, I tend to believe that all the tools and the skills that enable one to really succeed as an actor are the same skills and tools that enable them to succeed at life.
Wow, look at that.
I actually had someone ask me in one of my classes this week, they had been told by someone they had called upon to help them prep an audition scene for the class. They'd been told by this young performer, all of 27 years of age, this performer, who classes, acting classes, a thing of the past for him. He's been there, he's done it, and as a grizzled 27-year-old veteran, He wanted her to know that, you know, you can't learn anything from acting classes. You learn from going out and living your life. That's what teaches you everything you need to know as an actor. And my response when she asked for one was, yeah, because going out and living your life is so easy. I would argue that's why that kid needs my class, to teach him the life-building skills. But anyway, there you go.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, yes, it's good to have a plethora of experiences, but acting class is like going to the gym. And if you stop going after a while, you'll lose the ability to translate those experiences that you had in real life to something creative on stage or in front of the camera.
It's like going to the gym if your personal trainer is a licensed therapist. Okay, so we did hear, though, as I alluded at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com from our good friend Barry Murphy, who was the first to bring to my attention, and now it's everywhere. So again, Barry, sorry we didn't get to this earlier because, you know, we had a lot on our books to get to these last several shows. But this Twitter feed is everywhere. But Barry was the first one to bring it to my attention. Have you seen this? A producer is rather anonymously tweet shaming awful female character intros from scripts he's been sent.
No. That's pretty funny.
The Twitter handle is @femscriptintros. @femscriptintros.
Okay.
And so he's tweeting first appearances in scripts by female characters. You know, first appearances, for those who aren't savvy about screenplay language, the first time a character appears, there tends to be with it a description of that character, so that the producers and the readers can get some sense, can picture something, but also so that later, hopefully, that will be the basis for a casting breakdown. And he really is calling attention to how often, exclusively, the description is about the female's appearance. And at the very least, primarily about the character's appearance before getting to the character's inner makeup. So, you know, it's always about hot and how
smoking
they dress.
20-year-old.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because all writers are juvenile idiots. Is that right?
But then, you know, like Lily pointed out, she just quickly started scrolling through some pilot breakdowns. And here on the casting breakdowns, that's exactly what they're doing.
Oh, no. Just taking that verbatim, cut and paste?
Well, I don't know. But, like, you know, I'm both going to say what she told me, but I don't remember it exactly. But it's something along the lines of, you know, the type of woman who'd rather wear jeans and a T-shirt than a dress or a business suit, but who still pulls it off and looks like $1 million. Because that lets you know everything you need to know about a woman. There you
what?
Go.
What?
Hey, you know, I'm predicting the future on this show. That's part of
yes,
what I'm doing.
This is the whole thing. This is you from calling us from the year 2016, a couple months later.
So I've already predicted what, I don't know, end of March might be a live event of the week.
Right.
I feel very soon this is going to be a lawsuit of the week.
Oh.
Among all the big television series that have announced or are currently experiencing their revivals, not to mention names, but there's one from the 1970s that apparently is coming back, and that's Good Times. Have you seen
really?
This?
Really?
Yeah.
No. Ain't we lucky we got them?
The entire original cast of Good Times, with one exception, the late Esther Rolle, launched a crowdsourcing campaign to bring back the show free of any network or production company involvement.
Wait a sec. Did they not know that a show is sold to a network? They own that show sort of like till they either sell it or It's not like a 25-year copyright on it.
In the well, apparently, according to the lawyer, they have, and I would urge second opinion. They never trademarked or copyrighted the characters. So, so according to these, the lawyer and the cast, because they're setting it in the future, which means the present, i.e., they're not picking it up where it left off in the 1970s, which you'd hope, after all, they're all 50 years older,
right.
40 years
yes,
older.
Exactly.
It's about what happened to them 40 years down the line. They don't owe anybody any money or any participation. It's a whole new thing.
Okay, let me think about this. this must be an early 70s contract before it says all characters writing blah, blah, blah is owned and property of blank network.
I have a hard time believing that this is going to fly.
I do, too, because even future contracts, don't they have like a retroactive initiation policy on other properties owned? That to me seems like that is a clause in a contract I have seen and signed, network being
we could
that.
Call that the sanity clause. Okay.
Everybody knows there's no sanity clause.
Another future lawsuit of the week that I sense coming up, and this one breaks my heart. Long rumored to be an absolute masterpiece was Orson Welles' final unfinished film, The Other Side of the Wind, which more or less was finished and allowed one screening before the negatives were to be handed over to Iranian authorities, since the movie had been largely financed by the Shah and the Shah's family. And so long believed to be destroyed, these materials actually had been saved. The story behind how they were saved and who saved them is worthy of a movie itself. But about a year ago, there was a huge crowdsourcing campaign that raised a lot of money that was fronted by some very, very influential and notable Wells scholars, not the least of which was Peter Bogdanovich. A huge amount of money was raised to finish this film and to restore the materials so that everyone could enjoy what, by all accounts, legendarily was a masterwork. And I, of course, this is the holy grail for me, right? This is
right.
This is Rosebud, for crying out loud.
It is your Rosebud, absolutely.
But it turns out that maybe the filmmakers who launched that crowdsourcing campaign and raised more than $500,000 didn't quite have all their ducks in the row, legally speaking, in terms of rights. So I may not live to see the film, but at least I will be there to cover it as a lawsuit of the week. I'm so excited about that possibility, so why not just play it?
Totally.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Thank you, Garrett Watley. You know, Dean Haglund, the X-Files returned to television.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, you might not know that, because if you were blinking, literally, you would have missed it.
Okay, it aired last night, and I have not seen it yet. It's still on my DVR here.
This is,
so don't spoil it.
This is this is Babylon you're talking about. The episode
I'm talking Babylon,
where the gunmen appear in an I don't want to say otherwise, because that makes it seem like your appearance wasn't fun. Well, let's just call it flat. I think Babylon's a very interesting episode, and this shamanic sequence, which we're led to believe at the outset is, as you know, is a hallucination, and then we find out it can't. We're led to believe it's a drug-induced hallucination, and then we find out, of course, that there was no drugs involved. So what does it mean? What was it? So it's very shamanic in nature, And it's very interesting. To say that it's all played for laughs isn't quite right. It's a show with a lot on its mind, all about the binary world in which we live, and so it's an interesting episode. But like you said, you know, your fear was what people's reaction would be to the appearance of the gunman, and indeed, anger over that seems to have overshadowed for many people the quality and the strength of the episode itself.
Yeah, and of course, I saw some of that rage just at what landed directly in my inboxes, but didn't go out and see how much rage was out there. So fill me in.
Well,
how mad is everybody?
Yeah, I mean, look, apparently, you know, they did not use everything that was shot either. So there's talk that all the deletions will be used on a Blu-ray release of it. So thank God they're already promoting that. Did the gunman at any point have lines?
No, we never did.
Okay.
That was the weird thing. So that's why they were potentially flying me in and just rushing me to set and flying me out all on the same day because of the fact there was no lines. It was just us sitting around in a cowboy outfit.
And certainly worth bringing you all the way for that.
Well, you know, yeah.
I'm not saying worth it on your part, but I'm saying, you know, if I'm running a show, and God knows the odds of that ever happening are slim, although they might have increased because of the trending topic of the week on Facebook, but if I'm running a show and we're paying to bring an actor all the way around the world, I might just jot down some lines and have him say them just in case.
Well, I guess
we bought him. Let's put him to work would be my motto.
Right. I don't think Fox ever thought like that ever. So, I don't think money was the issue. I think it was always about, time, brevity, story. How do we do this? Where can we incorporate them? You know, that sort of thing.
So you... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And particularly if, Chris backed away from IDW's season 10 official canon line and then really is playing up that the gunmen are... shuffled off the mortal coil, then indeed,
but
how do you?
But indeed, there's nothing. What's interesting about it is, again, it's there's nothing in it that says one way or another that they're dead, not dead. In fact, one could make a strong case, and here we go, X-Files. Remember, I'm one of you, and I'm also gifted not only with insight, but as my previous predictions in this show will bear out, I'm really dogged by cunning foresight. So I would argue this, that the whole purpose of that shamanic trip that, and again, shamanic is my word. There is no medication being taken, and there is no shaman guiding Mulder, although he has experience in the shamanic realms through his investigations. So let me just call it that for sake of no other single word coming to mind. He goes on a shamanic journey that turns out not to be a medically induced trip, not a hallucination as we would medically define it. In that trip, the symbolism and is rich and telling, and the information he garners from it directly leads to the solution of the case, to the saving of lives. So it leads him into factual truth.
Okay?
Along this path, he encounters the gunmen, who are not as he last saw them. Indeed, they have aged quite clearly, and just as clearly, they may have put on a pound or two.
Hey, you take that back.
Okay, no, I wasn't necessarily speaking about you. All right. Anyway,
okay, good.
And this was not an ethereal plane where everyone in that honky-tonk were dead people. And how do we know this? Because Skinner's at that table, too.
Right.
So, it is people... now, maybe it combines people who are dead and alive. That's a possibility. But do you see what I'm saying? They have clearly aged. Who pictures, when they picture dead people, people who have aged past where they lived?
Right.
And... even, and if that's how, and if we're going to say this is a product entirely of Mulder's subconscious, it nevertheless is a subconscious that is aware of the truth. So if in his subconscious the gunmen live and have aged, I would argue that we've been given more than a little bit of reason to believe that it's because it's true that has happened.
Ah, I like it.
Does that make sense, given what we see in the... Okay, all right.
Yeah, and not only that, that was actually discussed on set, believe it or not.
Well, you didn't expose that. I said it. You have simply confirmed it.
Right, because, you know, how many of these conversations, acting-wise and all that sort of thing, do I share? Particularly when I signed an NDA agreement, which I guess now is null and void.
Well, we will wait on any further discussion. I wanted to talk about that because that was news of the week. Once you've seen the final two episodes, we will look back and we will talk about the run as a whole, the high points, the low points, and maybe where it goes from here.
Absolutely. I look forward to that.
Okay. Speaking of revivals, there was big news this week. Some of our listeners, including the lovely and talented Maddie Giles, wrote me that this was the best news ever. Honestly, anything that has to do with Star Trek returning to TV at this point, is that even news? Let alone best news? But anyway, as I stifle a yawn, let's discuss that CBS announced that Brian Fuller will indeed be serving as co-creator and showrunner of the new series set to premiere, I guess, next January for executive producer Alex Kurtzman, who co-wrote the first two films in the J.J. Abrams big screen reboot of the franchise.
Right. Yeah.
And people are very excited about this. Bringing Star Trek back to television means returning to its roots. And for years, these roots flourished under Brian's devoted care, says Alex Kurtzman of Brian Fuller, who had previously worked on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Yay! And on Star Trek Voyager. Are you fucking kidding me? This is good news?
Well, listen.
His encyclopedic knowledge of Trek canon is surpassed only by his love for Gene Roddenberry's optimistic future, a vision that continues to guide us as we explore strange new worlds. Fuller will remain as co-showrunner of the forthcoming American Gods. Good, because we certainly want someone whose attention is split. Apparently, people are a big fan of Brian Fuller. The only other thing I think I know that he's done is Pushing Daisies, which, again, are you fucking kidding me? This is good news?
Well, it's good news in one aspect, and that aspect is there's a guy who's got the knowledge, the encyclopedic knowledge of the universe, and so there'll be no tripping up of timelines. There'll be no...
Isn't that the name of your new a book of your watercolors of downtown buildings, an encyclopedic knowledge of the universe?
No, it's called the Illustrated Tour of Broadway Theaters or something.
But its subtitle is An Encyclopedic Knowledge of the Universe.
Right. Okay. But remember how everybody was super upset at it was Star Trek Nemesis, how that director had no whatchamacallits at all to previous timelines.
Whoa, you're getting technical.
I know. And so he said, my God, why didn't they get somebody in there who at least likes Star Trek and has a knowledge, a working knowledge of characters and timelines and who came and what flies what, which direction, you know, all that stuff.
Well,
I think Brian Fuller is a good option. And if his thing is split, that means there's going to be younger, fresher energy coming at it. But he's going to be there saying, no, that can't be right because – in episode whatever, that happened.
Okay. If this again, you know, Star Trek Voyager was a dog. Okay, let me just say that. And it had nothing to do with the optimistic future, according to Gene Roddenberry. These are people who are... It had more to do with Lost in Space than it had to do with Roddenberry's Star Trek. Okay.
Well, that's true. They were lost in space.
But let's assume that that had nothing to do with Brian Fuller in terms of the creation and what it was. You know, you got to write the show and produce the show that's been created. So, yeah. So maybe they are really going to give us a Trek, again, for the first time in a long time, which is a future worth working hard to build. Depiction of a future that gives us hope, maybe just to get up and do what we've got on our to-do list each and every day, which Star Trek at its best did. I certainly understand going towards someone who not only has a track record as a professional, but also, as you say, an encyclopedic knowledge and love, deep abiding love of Star Trek, especially in the wake of J.J. Abrams. I bag on J.J. Abrams. I kid him. You know, I'm a kidder. But
you kid him because you love.
But obviously, this was someone who went on record as never being a Star Trek fan. Now, I don't think someone needs to be a fan to be able to do good work of it. In fact, Justin Lin maintains that he's a huge Star Trek fan. Watch that trailer of the new one, right? It's amazing. Right. If that's what a fan does, we really don't want fans directing Star Trek. But after all, J.J. Abrams is a professional storyteller and a person of a certain amount of integrity. And so, you know, his job is to make a good film and an entertaining film. And he did do that with the first one. Was it Trek? No. And did that really become a huge point in the second one when it wasn't an entertaining film? Yes.
No.
You know, you go back to Nicholas Meyer, who really saved Star Trek with Star Trek II. And then did the famous rewrite on Star Trek IV and did Star Trek VI. So here's a man who has the creative hand in the three best Trek movies, or at least three of the four best Trek movies. And here was someone who'd never seen a minute of Star Trek before being hired to do Star Trek II. Not a fan, right? But someone who had proven himself by coming into the world of Sherlock Holmes, coming into the world of H.G. Wells, and bringing new blood into those. And so, quite rightly, they trusted that he was someone who would go in, roll up his sleeves, say, boy, people love this, so let me figure out what it is about it that really works, really appeals, so that I honor that. And that which does not work and does not appeal, I get rid of and replace it with something better.
Right. Now, you realize that was a huge risk. That could have failed, of course.
Of course it could have. And if it had failed in Star Trek II, which was not a huge risk because they did it on a TV budget. I think the second Star Trek movie, the budget was all the way down to like $10 million. So after the $45 million spent on the first one. So it wasn't the huge financial risk that you might think that it was, but indeed it was a risk and it paid off. And if it hadn't paid off, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about Brian Fuller, 34 years later.
Right. That's a good point.
Anyway, so caution against fans and love working, being in charge of something, but also, as you rightly point out, someone who has no interest in that thing maybe shouldn't be doing it either.
Well, because we've seen that go to hell, too. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm thinking now, because of J.J. Abrams, that it has to swing to super fan, fanny fans.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know,
especially if it's going to be something where you want people to come back week after week.
Yeah, absolutely. If it was, you know, two kids off the street who you never heard of it, everybody would be enraged.
Who's hiring those people? And how can I? I'll go get a wig and I'll pretend to be one of those kids.
You got the email that says I need a DP.
Okay, you still haven't figured that out. All right.
No, I haven't.
One of my favorite shows also as a kid, science fiction, Thunderbirds. Yeah.
Thunderbirds are go?
Thunderbirds are go at Amazon.
What?
They have ordered 4 13-episode seasons of the new Thunderbirds series with Rosamund Pike playing Lady Penelope.
Wow. Now, wait a sec. Is it still in Super Marionette Puppet Action?
I hope it's called? I hope so. I don't know any more than that, but we will do our research and we'll find out.
Yeah, because I saw a fake marionette. It's like a computer-generated 3D, and it's obviously there's no operators hanging over their heads. It seems that they've either modeled a three-dimensional marionette and made them sort of walk around, but it's got a weird, uncanny valley that is somewhere in between a marionette puppet and, you know, 3D graphics generator. So I wasn't too keen on the look. I sort of could stomach it, but I'm really hoping it goes retro.
Well, God knows we did not enjoy that Thunderbirds big screen movie directed by Star Trek's Jonathan Frakes. So maybe that's some of the bad karma that's been hitting Star Trek lately.
Oh.
Who knows? So much to get to. I mean, let's call the network. Let's just go 2 hours today. Hey, I have been enjoying the hell out of Other Space.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, one of, if not your very top choice for best show of last year.
I know. Isn't it fun? I mean, it's shocking at first when you go, wow, that's low budget. And, you know, there's some real...
But I guess it's low budget, and yet it looks high budget compared to one of my favorite sci-fi TV shows, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
It has that feel, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I what's really crisp is the character, the writing, and just the chemistry of the whole crew sort of really crackles after a while. It's one of these things that you hear about all the time. Going, oh, you know, it doesn't matter about costumes or lighting and stuff like that. If your characterizations are great, if the writing's great, the show's going to pop regardless of what's going on technically. And not that I'm belittling the technicality of this whole series, but clearly they're under money constraints. And yet, I love that show.
So too was Star Trek, especially in season 3, under huge monetary constraints. You couldn't leave the bridge. There were no crew members, right? They had to keep figuring out, how do we come up with storylines where there's no one on the planets, right? Because we couldn't pay for extras. And honestly, if you really do love Star Trek, you'll love Other Space.
Yeah, it's true.
Not just because of the budgets, but because of the spirit and the attitude of it. You know, it's terrific. The Star Trek fan in me loves it. And the fan of me who loves, you know, kind of savvy, media savvy comedy digs it as well.
Yeah, you're not finding it too goofy? I know I heard that from a few people who saw it. Thought it was a bit too
You know, the lead actor whose name I did not write down, but who's also in Deadpool, and he was in boy, he's everywhere, Blunt Talk with Star Trek's Patrick Stewart, he manages to really bring everything to kind of an emotionally real place for me.
Yeah, I know, right? Because he's the one actually as the beleaguered captain trying to figure everything out, sort of at the end of the day, comes to it, and he brings it, yeah. Whereas other, you know, I love Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000, but, you know, his comedy, his range has always been, you know, in the realm of sketch comedy. Is that a polite way of saying that?
Have you heard anything about this new, I guess it's already available on Hulu, I'm going to check it out, but maybe you've been checking it out, this James Franco vehicle based on the Stephen King work from J.J. Abrams, 11-23-63, is that what it's called? 11-22-63, about James Franco playing a history teacher who's going back in time to try to prevent the Kennedy assassination?
No. That sounds fascinating. Tell me more.
Well, that's all I know. I was hoping you would be able to tell me something. Well, we'll have to check this out or entreat our loyal listeners to let us know what they think. That would be very interesting. I will tell you what's fantastic. I will wag my finger at people when they deserve it, and I have wagged my finger at this man in the past, but I doff my cap when I believe it is deserved. A big doff of the cap to Ryan Murphy for the latest iteration of his American crime story, The People versus O.J. Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
This is such fun.
Is it really?
I want kind of John Travolta to get a spinoff where each season we get to follow Robert Shapiro in another chapter of his legal career. This is John Travolta as Robert Shapiro creating Legal Zoom. He's fantastic. And Courtney Vance as Johnny Cochran. It's an indelible performance, an indelible character. So much so, I think that it has to be a big influence behind. I just heard that a Johnny Cochran series is being developed, or another series of movies, but not necessarily starring Courtney Vance. But he's fantastic. There is some casting problems. I thought David Schwimmer as Robert Kardashian was going to bug the heck out of me. It's brilliant. The whole Kardashian stuff is some of the most knowing and telling and looking back at history, ironic portions of this whole chapter of American history. And wow. Schwimmer's fantastic. Nathan Lane as F. Lee Bailey, certainly a great actor and performer, Nathan Lane, working very hard, but that's bad casting. And
I don't see that.
And someone I've always loved, Sarah Paulson, who comes across quite well as Marcia Clark in the first episode, I think is not well served by the script and the direction every episode after that, and she is not finding a character. She's not finding a character in this thing, and it's really distracting.
Wow, that's a drag.
But overall, so much fun. So much fun. And
now, are they doing it tongue-in-cheek? Is there comedic elements to it? Or are they just going sort of verbatim court transcripts, that kind of thing?
They're not tongue-in-cheek. You can't say that it's tongue-in-cheek performance. No. No, there isn't any commenting on it being done. That said, many of these characters were people who harbored no small sense of illusion about themselves and their lives. These are political figures. They're larger than life figures. Bruce Greenwood as Gil Garcetti, for example, it is a show about the illusions that all these people held about themselves.
Wow.
And it's very funny. It's very knowing, very funny, and based on the painstakingly detailed research work in his book, I think it's called The Race for His Life, by Jeffrey Toobin, who was the legal analyst. So big fun there. Finally, before we leave television and spend what little time we have left talking about the season of self-congratulation and maybe even celebrity deaths, I want to discuss that strange moment that befalls us all when our girlfriends from film school become the top trending news topic on Facebook. Can forget that chestnut? It's that coming of age. The fantastic Channing Dungey, who, as I said, was my girlfriend in film school and who I worked with, she just became... And congratulations, seriously, congratulations. She became, quite rightly, president of ABC.
What?
And in so doing, the first African-American to be the president of a major network.
Fantastic.
One of the most touching results of this was that Channing's niece, from her sister Marin, who came to fame first playing Francie on J.J. Abrams' Alias. Marin's daughter, young girl, was in school, and they had to write essays this week because it is African-American History Month. And her essay was about her aunt. And because her aunt's just become a major trailblazer.
Oh, that's nice.
I don't like to deal strictly in the positive, so let me throw some paranoia and conspiracy where timing is concerned at you. Yes, this is before, you know, pilot season and before what shows get picked up. And Channing has had a great track record running drama for ABC, you know, responsible as an executive for shows ranging from Scandal to Quantico to How I Got Away with Murder to right. Once Upon a Time. So she's kicking it. She's nailing it. She's right. Kicking it in the ass.
Right. Nothing but net.
But the week before the Oscars are on ABC. And ABC, you see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
ABC, you know, has no small stake in hashtag Oscar so white.
Right.
Right. In this controversy, when you are permanently partnered as the television network home of the show that regularly gets the second largest audience after the Super Bowl of any show during the year. Right.
Right.
And I think you make a fairly obvious announcement that you do not support the lack of diversity when, you know, on the part of the Academy, on the part of the Oscars, by naming your first black president.
Right. So
am I wrong in thinking that the timing could have something to do with that?
Yeah. I mean, if you are conspiratorially minded and... I'm gonna lay down the word cynical on that one, Mister, because I would think that even though they are, like you said, suffering under the Academy's thing, it is the Academy's thing. It's not the network having any influence whatsoever on who the Academy nominates or anything like that. And if this was some sort of salve to try and smooth that over, I would say that's such a far field from where the Academy's head's at that I don't think it would make a difference.
Maybe. The president of the Academy is a black woman herself. But I just think, you know, it is a network that embraces diversity. And I don't know. If I'm going to make this move anyway... you know, if I'm the CEO of whatever parent company, if I'm going to make this move, I don't know. I do think we gain some interesting traction by doing it now. But I'm sure that it has much more to do with scheduling of pilot season and all that sort
of stuff. I'm not going to throw...
It's at least an interesting coincidence.
Well, I'll give you coinkydink. But I'm going to stop your conspiracy theory.
And I'm going to have to ask you never to say coinkydink ever again. We had a rule about that. I won't explain to you what DP means. You do not. Okay.
I got to look this up. Anyway, hey, wait a sec. Did it end badly with you and your girlfriend from high school? Or is there a pitch meeting that we can get now that she's head of TV development?
It did not end badly.
Oh. So technically,
I like that those are the two choices. I'm not, did it end badly or are we getting a pitch meeting? The truth might be somewhere in between, Dean Haglund.
I see. Okay, I'm just checking.
Hey, let's talk about the Oscars. Let's talk about the awards themselves. Coming up next week, we have a special Oscar show that we're going to do, but not our usual Oscar Smackdown, because which we may bring back next year. Or certainly when you and I are in the same continent again.
Right.
But we got a very special Oscar Smackdown show that's going to be different than any we've done before. So look forward to that. But I was, you know, I'm a student of history. And
yes, you are.
I found it fascinating that Mad Max Fury Road and The Revenant are only the fourth and fifth films ever to be acknowledged in all the craft categories with nominations.
Oh.
Isn't that amazing? Only five films, and two of them this year, only five films have ever been nominated for cinematography, costume design, film editing, production design, sound editing, sound mixing, and visual effects. Even more rare, of course, well, of course it would have to be, five have only achieved that, and only one ever swept all seven of those categories. Can you name it?
Godfather.
Titanic. Godfather might not have been a bad call, sir. I would imagine that it swept most of those, but visual effects.
Oh, right.
There you go. There you go.
Well, I mean, the cotton balls in Marlon Brando's cheeks, that was a visual effect.
I was asked by our friend Sean Parker to tell this story on the show, so I'm going to do this. And I don't know if I've ever told you this before, but if I'm repeating it, it's a goodie. Okay. Speaking of film school, as I was years ago, Driving Miss Daisy won Best Picture and got the most nominations that year, I believe, of any film. But the director was not nominated. So indeed, it created this historic precedent because up until that time, every film that had ever won Best Picture had at least had their director nominated, right?
Right. Theoretically, you make a great movie, it's the director's...
Yeah, how can it be the Best Picture of the year without even the director being nominated? I believe Argo won without Ben Affleck being nominated. Is that possible? I think that might have also repeated
that might have happened, yeah.
So years ago, when this happened, I happened to have as my thesis advisor... My thesis production advisor, not a thesis post-production advisor. That was right. Richard and Barbara Marx, editors of the aforementioned Godfather. The production supervisor was George Schaefer, who was a wonderful gentleman and happened to be the chairman of the director's branch of the Academy. And for people who don't know this, you tend to vote for most categories. Their nominations come out of votes just by those caucuses themselves. So directors vote for the nominees for Best Director, actors vote for the acting categories, screenwriters for screenplay, etc. And then everyone votes for the winners. And indeed, everyone votes to nominate Best Picture, for example.
Right.
Is that clear? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why you will sometimes have these directors get nominated for films that get no other nominations. David Lynch for Blue Velvet, Martin Scorsese for Last Temptation of Christ. Controversial films, maybe edgy artistic films that might be pushing the envelope too much for the Academy, might be socially a little too controversial for the Academy, but the director's branch enjoys supporting their brethren for unique individual artistic vision, and good for them. In the case of Affleck, possibly, and certainly Bruce Beresford, who directed Driving Miss Daisy, they went the other direction, and they did not nominate the men who would eventually have directed the Best Picture winner. So how is that possible? How is it the Best Picture of the year without, how does it get the most nominations without the director being nominated? And I asked George Schaefer that, and this was before it even won, but I said, how does it get the most nominations in all these categories, and the director isn't one of the top five even? And George looked at me quite bemused, and he said, he was a gentle man, and he said, well, when you look at it from that perspective, of course what you're saying makes sense. You've got to understand, however, that when we in the director's branch voted for our nominees, we did not know at that time that the rest of the Academy would be so fucking wrong about Driving Miss Daisy.
Wow. That was his thing.
A story from this year's director nominees that I love, though not necessarily for the reason that people might expect and for the reason that it's getting championed. But Lenny Abramson, who does such a fantastic job directing Room this year, he had only done a couple of little scene and very small films set in Ireland when he got the job to direct Room. His much more high visible 2014 Sundance hit, Frank, starring Michael Fassbender, had yet to be made when he got the job for Room. And many A-list directors were very interested in Emma Donoghue's book because it had become a hot property. The notoriety of these kind of abduction cases really fueling that. And So this independent director wrote a 5-page letter to the author of the book explaining not only why the book mattered, in his opinion, but what his vision of the film would be and how he would set out to direct it. And this letter has gone public, and many people are championing it, rightly so, because it's an important lesson in how successful directors must be able to share their vision for a movie before they start making it. And this is only going to become more and more important as the years go on.
Right, how to communicate your vision.
Absolutely. And with other artists, with actors, with money people.
Investors,
with executives. But how about this, Dean? How about just the lost art of letter writing itself?
I know. Dear sir, how do you format it? Where's the indentation? All of that stuff.
But I mean, you know, letter writing is, it is a lost art. Because technology has replaced it, first and foremost, right? But boy, can you imagine the power of just getting a 5-page letter on hard paper sent to you that is thoughtful and well explained? The presentation medium of that is important.
Wow.
And I can't stress this enough. I don't do this as much as I should, but boy, getting a letter versus an email versus a memo matters. But boy, you got to be able to deliver the goods in it. But if you can, I urge you, no matter what your field is or no matter why you're reaching out to someone, a letter is a powerful, powerful tool, and only all the more powerful because it does seem to be a lost art.
Absolutely. And think about in a tangent story, the executives at Sony now are faxing each other letters and memos because of the email hack that they have still now are all paranoid. They don't want to be getting that information out. So it's back to the fax machine and handwriting notes to each other and phoning them up.
Imagine that. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What's next, Dean? Face-to-face meetings? talking on the phone.
Talking on the phone? That'd be ridiculous.
Although the NSA would get that. But
yeah.
we're over time, but we have to get to this because it won't matter next week. Under the category of hashtag #OscarSoWhite, there was an interesting headline called This Has Happened Before, How Gregory Peck Led a Revolution and Infused Youth and Diversity into the Oscars. For all the talk about historic moves recently to change the makeup of the membership and board of governors in response to the threatened Oscar boycott over the lack of diversity in not only this year, but last year's nominations, you know, changes in membership that we talked about extensively on, I think, last week's show, where we proposed maybe some rule changes that might make a more meaningful difference. It's interesting that in the wake of all this talk about these historic changes, people seem to be overlooking that the Academy faced a similar crisis before and found a way to make it work. Again, student of history, it is interesting looking to the past for solutions to seemingly insoluble problems today, right? Nearly 50 years ago, none other than Atticus Finch himself used his position to oversee a series of sweeping changes in 1967 when he was first elected president. And, you know, not long thereafter, you see things like In the Heat of the Night winning Best Picture. And certainly you look at the movies that got awarded Oscars by the early 70s, this was changing things a great deal. So it's happened before. And also, what better segue than talking about Atticus Finch could there be than
celebrity deaths?
Then when we need to discuss the death of Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, died at the age of 89 in her hometown of Monroeville. Now, are you a fan of the To Kill a Mockingbird novel?
I recall having to read it as opposed to finding it and reading it. So I think it was one of those school assignments that made it more miserable than I bet it probably was. So I should go back and visit it now with not having Mr. Suderman standing over me.
It it was interesting because even when it was published, you know, the publisher tempered her expectations, you know, saying there in the 1960s, a book with racism at its center involving a rape trial was not a thing in 1960 to make people run to the bookstores. You know, she was counseled that if we sell 2,500 copies and break even, you should be proud.
Right.
There's a little twist in that story. Turns out they were wrong.
yes.
But the second twist, of course, and we've talked about this on the show, is this book wins a Pulitzer Prize in 1961, a year adapted, I think, just a year later. Was it 62 that, you know, Best Picture winner To Kill a Mockingbird came out?
Yeah.
And then, of course, Harper Lee disappears, which is a major twist, right? Seemingly cemented in the firmament of top American writers, that's it. She legendarily becomes a recluse. Although, as you
right.
and I love to talk about, being a recluse and not doing interviews are not the same thing. She apparently was a very public person, very open, you know, not a miscreant or a recluse in any way whatsoever, just shunning the publicity machine.
So therefore, what a weirdo.
And one of the reasons you got to believe that she did was because that question that she didn't want to answer, what about a follow-up? What's next?
What's next?
When indeed, To Kill a Mockingbird was the sequel, right? Because
yes.
she'd written a book that To Kill a Mockingbird was ostensibly a prequel to, because the first book was even more dark and hard
right.
to sell. And that finally came out, Go Set a Watchman. And this came out to mixed reviews. And you got to believe, I've not read this. I look forward to reading it. But you got to believe that if it got mixed reviews, given how beloved To Kill a Mockingbird is, and how much this tears the illusion of Atticus Finch down, that mixed reviews must mean that it's actually probably pretty good. Right? Because people would have been outraged by this. And that's indeed why she waited until she was too old to give a damn to finally release the true work that she had always wanted to publish. And it reveals that, of course, the incidents in To Kill a Mockingbird are being shown through the eyes of an unreliable narrator. That Atticus Finch, far from being a hero, was in fact a member of the Klan. So, anyway, I can't wait to read the Go Set a Watchman. And not only that, but to pitch it in our pitch meeting at ABC as a weekly series. Okay. Here's our pitch. Here's our pitch. It focuses on a Klansman. All right. Also, another author who often garnered, I guess we could say, mixed reviews, but whose work I genuinely enjoyed a great deal. Umberto Eco died.
Oh, yes.
Did you see this? That he died at 84 at his home in Milan. Now, Umberto Eco was an Italian scholar, first and foremost, in the arcane field of semiotics, who became later the author of best-selling novels, notably The Name of the Rose, which was a blockbuster mystery.
Massive hit.
Massive hit. Got made into a movie starring Sean Connery, a movie I love, by the way.
Did you like that movie?
I really do, and I would think you would love it, too. The encoded wisdom in comedic artworks that the church is trying to suppress. Because laughter brings us closer to the nature of the Christ than anything else. I would think you would love that that work. Have you seen the movie recently? Or
no? That you said it, I don't remember that plot point at all.
Yeah,
is that the main?
Yeah, really. When you come back, we ought to watch this. In fact, maybe this is a movie that we've been talking about. We should sit down and do what we did with the X-Files movie. And give it a reading. Maybe we do The Swimmer, and maybe we make another one, Name of the Rose.
Hey, now you're talking.
Because I love that we would do this towards films that are not necessarily glorified masterpieces. You know, that we really say, hey, if you bring a certain way of reading, it opens up a whole range of wonderful mysteries and artistry in these works that you might have missed because reviewers had to write in 15 minutes what they thought of a two-hour movie that spent 3 years of people's lives making. So,
right, and it steered you in a wrong direction.
But anyway, what was interesting about Umberto Eco was that rather than segregating his academic life from his popular fiction, he tried to infuse his seven novels with as many of his scholarly preoccupations as possible, such as interpreting cultures through their signs and symbols, through words and religious icons and clothing and scores and even cartoons, which made me think of you as well. He was very interested in that. And he, of course, published more than 20 nonfiction books on these subjects. But, you know, there's something about when you pull off the combination of these fields of study and incorporate them into a fictional story, that it allows, I don't know, a very interesting alchemy to take place where I think it sparks the imagination of people, the way Name of the Rose did. Hell, the way that Lucas did with Star Wars, you know, translating the works of Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, exactly. And recontextualizing it.
Did you ever read Foucault's Pendulum?
No, I did not, actually.
Because that's the heaviest book I've ever read, I think. And when I say heavy, I don't mean in terms of its tone or its philosophy. I mean, literally, that is a gigantic book.
Yeah, I think I've always seen it on a bookshelf, and I thought, well, that would kill me if it came off. And so I've always left it up on the bookshelf.
It told the story of a French physicist in the 1800s who devised a mechanism to demonstrate the rotation of the Earth. And it mixes allusions to the Kabbalah and mathematical formulas and Disney characters. It became a worldwide bestseller, even though it did not receive the near unanimous acclaim that critics had for The Name of the Rose. It was a little thick, a little dense for some people. But anyway, yeah. Umberto Eco dead at 84. That pretty much needs to do it. It's too bad we didn't get to some new movies. We didn't get to the panic that is setting in over at Warner Brothers over this gigantic turd of a movie that is Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. They've already scrapped their Justice League plans. $400 million this movie has cost. So anyway, maybe we'll talk about that amidst all our Oscar smackdown we have planned for next week.
Awesome. Can't wait.
But that brings us to an end of a very long installment of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour.
It's not literally an hour.
You can... Chillpack Hollywood Hours. You can download every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com.
Yep.
You can, of course...
Find us on Facebook.
Like us.
Facebook. Yeah, like us there. Facebook, Chillpack Hollywood. We have our own website. Did you mention that one?
Yeah, I did. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil.
And you can email us, like all people do.
Like all people do. Yeah, but like be careful what you ask for from us.
I got to look that up. I have
all
no
right,
idea.
Please don't. Anyway, what else? Oh, thank you to Blog Talk Radio for hosting us. And, of course, thank you to Empire State Gas for sponsoring us. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.